I think that true philanthropy comes from the heart of yourself. And growing up as a poor girl, I mean, really poor, not just not having wonderful economic circumstances or material things, but literally poor, like no running water kind of poor. And having education being the road to freedom for me. My grandmother only finished third grade, but taught me to read the Bible. So I grew up knowing how to read and put myself in the position of, by the time I got to kindergarten, I knew all the biblical names from the Christian Bible. So I had a central moment growing up with my mother in Milwaukee after leaving Mississippi. My mother had said there would be no Christmas that year, and therefore there would be no Santa Claus. And I remember being embarrassed about having to go to school, because we all know that the Christmas, the holidays, is about going to school and saying what you got, and I got this. And so I was embarrassed about what I would tell, what would my story be. I wasn't so worried about not getting anything. I was worried about what the story was going to be, but what I did or did not get. About midnight that night, Christmas Eve, some nuns showed up at our door. Three nuns carrying baskets of food and toys for my half-sister and brother and myself. And I remember feeling relief. Felt not joy, but relief. And a sense of wonder that somebody who didn't know me would be able to figure out where we lived and come to our house with a turkey and food for Christmas. And managed to bring a Tammy doll for me, although I'd been wishing for Barbie. I never forgot that moment. And years later, when I was contemplating how I wanted to use my own resources, I thought about those nuns. So my first venture was to go to South Africa and to be able to do for other children, to create that experience that I'd felt for myself, that sense of wonder that somebody cared about me who didn't even know my name. Because I know that it, for me, it was more than the toys, it was more than the food, it was that somebody reached out and literally the energy of them touched the heart of me. So I wanted to do that. I also knew what a big role education had played in my life, and I always knew from the beginning of my success that I would have to find a way to give back. That's just a part of the way my grandmother raised me, that to those who much is given, much is expected. She never lived to see how much was given, but I was, you know, taught to give back. So I started out and made a lot of mistakes, because I think all of us go through the process of figuring out the difference between charity and true philanthropy. I made a lot of mistakes, because I wanted to give. The heart of me knew that I wanted to have other people experience some of what I had experienced, but I wasn't quite sure of how to do it. So I made a lot of mistakes based on emotional giving. People refer to me as a brand now, the Oprah brand. I never knew what a brand was when I first started out. I didn't even know what that was. I became a brand by making every decision flow from the truth of myself. Every choice I made, for every show that was going to be on the air, I made based upon, does this feel right? Does this feel right? Does this feel right? And I do the same thing in terms of my philanthropic efforts. It's where do I feel that I can have the most impact or make the, or do the most good. I had the great benefit when we had done Christmas Kindness, which was truly an emotional decision. I want to go to South Africa. I want to go to South Africa, and I want to do for all of these kids what someone had done for me. I ended up being invited by Nelson Mandela to stay at his home for 10 days. And I was at first very intimidated, because I'd said to my partner, Stedman, oh my God, what are we going to talk about? I don't know what I'm going to talk about. For 10 days and 10 nights in Nelson Mandela's house. And Simon said, why don't you try listening? And, that's a marvelous idea. So when we were talking one day in a conversation, and we got to the point where we were comfortable enough to sit in silence, that's how you know you made it. You can be in a room and don't have to say anything. we were just in the room reading the newspaper and started a conversation about what was in the paper, poverty and how to change it. And I said, the only way to change poverty is through education. And one day I would like to build a school in South Africa. And he said, you want to build a school? Got up, called the Minister of Education. And by that afternoon, I was in a meeting talking about building a school. So the school for me was the way in, because I knew that education, taking a child out of their village, creating an environment for them where they have aspiration and can feel the spirit of themselves. And what I know is true is that true spirituality, the real spirit of every human being, is that part of ourselves which is drawn to hope, which is drawn to hope. And every one of us has that thing inside of us, that spirit that is drawn to hope. And that's what I wanted to do, was to create an environment where girls, and I chose girls because I am one, have been one, understand that, don't know nothing about boys. And I wanted them to feel the strength and power of hopefulness, that you can do and be and fulfill the possibility of your creation. So that's why I do what I do. When after setting up this school, there was a one of the dorm parents was involved in sexual abuse. She was later acquitted, but I still believe the girls. First of all, never in all of my wildest imaginations in preparing for the school, we thought we thought of everything, including in knowing how devastating the crime situation can be in South Africa, electrifying all the fences around the borders and making sure that men were off the campus by a certain time of night. Never occurred to me or anyone, I think, that you would have abuse or charges of abuse from a female on campus. And so when that happened, there were lots of people who said, oh my goodness, okay, does this, you know, destroy the dream? No, because I held on to what is the greater vision of that. What it taught me, that the real key is not making emotional decisions as I did with, I want to build a school, I want to help girls like myself, but starting with the infrastructure and the leadership that can sustain it long term. I think that's where the biggest mistakes have been made, particularly in Africa, is people have really hopeful ideas and they have really, you know, altruistic visions. But if you don't create the system and put in the infrastructure and have the leadership, and in many cases you have to, as you know, Melinda, you have to train the people first in order to even begin to create the infrastructure. So we all go in with our big ideas and our great ideas, but if the platform hasn't been laid for long-term sustainability, and particularly, I would say, biggest mistake is leadership. You have to have people whose vision is not only aligned with yours, but they also carry the passion for the vision as you do. Not just, oh, I want to execute, or I just want to, you know, work in this. You need people who are equally as passionate about it as you are. And when you can do that, then you at least have a chance. What I learned over the years in my 35,000 interviews with people, and still counting, is that there's a common denominator in the human experience. That whether I was talking to a convict, I interviewed a father in prison who murdered his two daughters. I interviewed a group of women in Texas who'd all murdered their children. I've talked to victims of abuse. I've talked to people who've been through traumatic circumstances in their life, people who've had great victories in their life. I've talked to almost every celebrity you could imagine. And at the end of every single one of those interviews, in one form or another, each of them said this. I finished interviewing five men who all admitted to being child molesters, and told in graphic detail how they lured children and seduced children. And it was really pretty profound, I would say, compelling. At the end of it, they said, At the end of Beyoncé dancing on stage in all of her Beyoncé-ness, she turned to me and said, "Was that okay?" So what I learned in all of those thousands of interviews is that there is a common denominator in our human experience. And when I go into any interview, no matter how intimidated I might be or how, oh my gosh, I've never talked to this person before, I know that that's the line of truth that's running through. Everybody wants to know, did you hear me? And did what I say matter? And that's in your own personal relationships. That's with your children. That's every argument you've ever had is really about, are you hearing me? I'm sure somebody's actually said those words in this room. You don't hear me. Are you hearing me? So fundamentally, the desire to be heard, the desire to be validated, the desire to know that what you're doing is meaningful in the world is something that we all hold for ourselves. Just this past week on my network own, I do something called Super Soul Sunday, and I was interviewing Carolyn Mace, who wrote a book called Anatomy of Spirit. And what's really exciting for me is that we were able to broadcast that not just on the cable platform, but to also blast it around the world. So we simulcast it around the world. So all around the world, people are tweeting in, thousands of people at the same time. And she said something that really hit a nerve. I knew it would hit a nerve with everybody because it hit a nerve with me. She was talking about how most people lead their lives following a course that is not their own. And that unless you can find the course that is truly your own, you will remain off course. And she was talking about how so many women betray themselves. And that when you betray yourself in relationships, regardless of what those relationships are, then you are no different than the person who hurt you. Now, that's just a simple little sentence. When you betray yourself, you're no different than the person who hurt you. Most of us in this room are cognizant of that. We're aware of that. But there's a whole world of people who are not. So what comes back to me is all these people who are tweeting, oh my God, I never thought of it that way before. That to me is the purest validation, because the reason why I wanted to do that show is so that people would feel and be able to discover a path to better themselves, a way to see themselves differently. And that one little phrase, when you betray yourself, you become no different than the people who hurt you. Open the door for that. So I, in that way, am validated because I'm very clear about what my purpose on earth is. I'm very clear that the work that I do on television is just a way of me manifesting myself as a vessel and a vehicle for the larger energy that I call God, for the larger universal purpose that I call God. That's what it is for me.
Mind doesn't say anything because it's just one generic word which does not describe different dimensions of what the mind is. Mind is not just one something sitting here and doing something, okay? There is really no such thing as mind. In the yogic culture, there is no mind. There is a physical body, there is a mental body. Because what you're calling as mind right now is a certain combination of memory and intelligence. There is memory in your body, more memory in your body than you can imagine. You definitely don't remember how your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother looked like. But her nose is sitting on your face right now. Yes, you don't remember a thing consciously, but your body remembers 100% how 10 generations ago your grandmother was. Your body still remembers. A million years ago how your forefathers were, your body remembers, isn't it? It's not forgotten and it's not going to forget. Your mind is not capable of this kind of memory. Your body has a trillion times more memory than your so-called brain. This whole shift towards the brain and intellectual process is a European malice. They gave too much significance to thought. This has happened because they lived under a subjugated society, religiously subjugated society, where you're not supposed to think anything except what's written in some book, otherwise you're dead. They lived like this for a long time. Because of this, when they got little freedom to think and manage to live, they started celebrating their thought too much. Let's understand the context of thought. You can only think from the data that you already have gathered. That means you can never think anything new. You can recycle it, you can rehash it, you can produce permutations and combinations of it, but you cannot think something absolutely new. It is not in the nature of the thought to come up with something new. It can only recycle the past. That means if you dedicate yourself to your thought process, if you enshrine your thought process, you are ensuring nothing new ever happens in your life. So thought need not be celebrated like this. That's why in this culture, thought has never been given so much significance. What you think is your psychological drama. We don't think much about that because it's your drama. Your drama is important for you. Somebody else's drama, it's important for them. Everybody thinks their drama is their most important drama in the universe. This is everybody's experience because they're so identified with their own psychological drama. This psychological drama should not determine the nature of your life because this is just a small happening compared to the life process. Life is a much deeper intelligence than intellect. We can look at the yogic system looks at the mind as 16 parts. Those 16 parts are further broken and they're taken up to 84,000 parts. But now if I talk about 84,000, already there's a segment which says no. So I will make it 4. I'm taking away 80, okay? I'm being fair to you. Only 4. 4 fundamental parts. One is the intellect, which we have in modern world, in today's world, we are unnecessarily giving too much significance to intellect and we will pay an enormous price for this. You will come to a place where you'll know everything, but you'll know nothing of life significance. Really. Today you will see this happening to children. For the first time, this generation you see, 10, 11-year-old or 12-year-old children, they look bored. When you were 10, 11, you did not know what is boredom. It was not possible. It was too exciting to be alive and looking around. You will see 10, 12-year-old children all looking bored because they've seen the cosmos through their phone screen. They know it all. And especially in the Western countries, you will see this happening at 8, 10. They're really bored. You'll see in the school buses, they're all bored. Because by the time you're 12, you already had one love affair. You know what is a break. You know how to all this recover from that. You tasted alcohol. You've seen this. Probably you've gone into all kinds of physical things. And you know the cosmos. What more? By the time you're 15, there's really no purpose for you to exist for many of them. You should not be surprised if this culture continues. I'm not saying this is a prediction. It is something that I see beginning to happen. In another 50 or 100 years' time, if 25 to 50% of the people commit suicide, you should not be surprised because life needs some exuberance. If too much information happens to you without experience, that exuberance will be gone. And a sense of false sense of knowing becomes so strong in you. This is the danger of intellect, because intellect wants to dissect everything. Intellect is like a scalpel. The sharper it is, the better it is. It wants to dissect and know. Dissection works with some things, not with all aspects of life. If you want to know the poor frog, you remember the poor frog that you crucified and cut, and great knowledge you acquired from all that torture is unbelievable. How much knowledge you know. For the torture that that frog went through, how much knowledge you have acquired is quite unbelievable. All that you got to know. Now you got interest, suddenly you got interested, the mother that you had ignored. You want to know your mother today. Please get yourself a sharp knife. Start the dissection. You may know everything about her liver, kidney, heart, but you won't have a mother left, that's all. So life cannot be known by breaking it up. You can know physical things by breaking it up. You cannot know life by breaking it into pieces. But this is the nature of the intellect. The whole modern science has evolved from human intellect. Because it's produced technological benefits, you can't argue against it. Because people, they think they're scientists. They know nothing about science. They're just enjoying their iPhone. They think they're scientists because they can do this. No. Technology is fine, it's brought much comfort and convenience, but it will not bring life to us. So intellect is like this. Intellect will be useful only depending upon what it is identified with and what is held, what holds this, how steadily. So the next dimension of the mind, the first one is called as buddhi, which is the intellect. The second one is called as ahankara. Ahankara does not mean ego, this, that. It means the identity. Whatever you identified with, your intellect functions only around that. Simple, if you just identify with a nation, if you say I'm an Indian, everything Indian looks beautiful. If you cross the border and you say you're something else, all that looks beautiful. So whatever you identified with, it's only with that the intellect functions. So ahankara is the identity. How consciously and how steadily your ahankara has been created will determine the effectiveness of your intellect. Just because it's sharp, it does not mean it will be effective, because sharp intellect or a sharp knife can cause any amount of damage to you. If you have a sharp knife and you don't have a steady hand, you will cut yourself all over the place. That's all that's happening. Human suffering is just this. You don't know how to hold this intellect in your hand properly. Every day you're cutting yourself. So all suffering is on self-help, because your own mind causing this to you all the time. No matter what happens, people suffer. Whichever way they suffer, because they don't know how to hold this intellect. If you had the mind of an earthworm, you would be quite peaceful. You're trying to do it in so many ways to reduce the sharpness of the intellect by drink, by drug, by overeating, by doing all kinds of things. Somehow, you take away the sharpness because the damn thing hurts. It hurts not because that's its nature. It hurts because you do not know how to hold it. The next dimension of the mind is called as manas, which is a huge volume of memory. It is not here or there. Entire body carries memory. So manomaya kosha, this is called. Huge sack of memory. This memory is in various stacks. We'll not go into all these details, considering some people have said a clear no. They don't want to have a mind. I'm sorry, they don't want to know anything about the mind. So the fourth dimension of the mind is called as chitta. Chitta means it's pure intelligence. It is unsullied by memory. It has no trace of any kind of memory. It's just pure intelligence. If you touch this, then you have access to what you're referring to as the source of creation, because all kinds of things might have been fed to you. God is this, God is love, God is compassion, God is kind, whatever. All these things have been made up, because whatever somebody is deprived of, they will attribute that quality to their idea of God. Your ideas of God have come only because you do not know how this whole creation happened. Because you don't have an answer, you made it up. Because you're a human being, you said a big human being is sitting up there. Oh, how can he do all this? If somebody asks, he has 10 hands, so he does a lot of things, not like you. Whatever. It's all right for children. But essentially, because you do not know how creation happened, you are coming up with explanations. So that which is the source of creation, don't believe what I say, what anybody says. Pay attention to one piece of creation. Just take a flower, pay attention to this. Pay an attention to a leaf or an atom or an ant. All you will see is phenomenal intelligence beyond anything you can imagine. Yes? But nobody told you God is intelligence. But this culture has said this to you in many ways. They told you Chidakasha, Chidambara, and so many things to tell you if you touch your chit, the whole existence becomes yours. Everything that's worth knowing is right here, because you have access to the source of creation. So these are the four types of your, four dimensions of your mind. Unfortunately, the modern education thinks by just feeding information and keeping the intellect reasonably sharp, everything is going to happen. No. You will rip this planet apart looking for well-being. You may lose the planet, or you may manage to go to another planet and start your work again there, but well-being will not happen. If well-being has to happen, you have to dig a little deeper into this one. Otherwise, no.
It's very important to understand that your body is a process. It's not a thing. There's, in fact, I told you yesterday that there's no such thing as a thing. There are no nouns in the universe, only verbs. Okay? Your thought is an activity. Your emotions are an activity. By activity means they come and then they disappear. Okay, thoughts are an activity, your emotions are an activity, and perception is an activity. You know, what you're perceiving right now, you won't be perceiving in the next minute. not exactly the same thing. And then, of course, when you walk out of here, it'll be something different. So thought is an activity. Emotions are an activity. Perceptions are an activity. And our body is a perceptual experience. You don't have the same body today that you had when you were a baby or a teenager, or that you even had a year ago. 98% of all the atoms in your body that were there a year ago aren't there today. Okay? So people identify with their body, but it's an experience, just like a thought is an experience. And even the universe is an experience. And it's not the same today as it was 13.8 billion years ago. Actually, dig out the George Harrison song. Okay, that'll summarize everything in the end. Okay, so your body is a process, and you cannot identify with an experience because no experience lasts even a microsecond. When I came on the stage, that's gone, right? A minute ago is gone. A second ago is gone. By the time you hear my sentence, the beginning of my sentence is gone. So this is what the rishis call the mistake of the intellect. That the intellect makes a mistake. It confuses reality with the experience in reality. Reality is eternal, timeless. But the experience in reality, actually you can't catch it. You can't catch the past, you can't catch the future, and you can't even catch the present. Because as soon as the present occurs, as an experience, it's over. So the German philosopher Wittgenstein, he said, our life is a dream, we are asleep. But once in a while, we wake up enough to know that we're dreaming. So what do we wake up to? We wake up to reality. And what is reality? It's the consciousness that is dreaming. It's projecting the dream. Now, last night you all had dreams, and most of you don't even remember them, right? They're gone. So too, this is a dream. And you know, how many people remember what happened when they were between 8 and 9, or between 5 and 6, or how many people remember when they learned to speak the English language or any language? But you did. So just because you don't remember doesn't mean that it didn't happen, okay? Now, there are people who remember other lifetimes, but if you ask them what they had on Tuesday for lunch, they won't be able to tell you. And why is that? Because we only remember things that we pay attention to or give significance to, especially emotional significance. So you may not remember what happened 3 weeks ago at 5 p.m., unless you were maybe with your sweetheart, and he or she said, will you marry me? This is a diamond ring, and opened a bottle of champagne, then you'll remember, right? So memory is very fickle, okay? It's not who we are. Now, in the understanding of Vedanta, the memory, the seeds of memory are called karma. Karma is the seed of memory, which is called sanskara. And the seed of memory, sanskara, creates vasanas, which are subtle desires which take our soul through a cosmic journey until enlightenment. Okay, so your body is a process. It's a process. You cannot identify with your body or your mind, because they're both processes, or with the perceptual experience of the world. At a more fundamental level, it is energy and information. Your gene expression is influenced by your thoughts, emotions, relationships, social interactions, environment, which is the whole science of epigenetics, which is overtaking genetics. You can change the neural networks of your brain to optimize physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being. It's the new science of neuroplasticity. Only 5% of disease-related gene mutations are fully penetrant. You can change your relationship to time, because what do we mean by that? Time is how we measure experience. So we say, I had a good time, time flew. I was in love, time didn't exist. I was at the dentist, time dragged. Okay? I have so many deadlines to meet, I'm running out of time. That's the most dangerous internal dialogue. Okay? Because when you keep saying, I'm running out of time, it shows the quality of your awareness. And so, you know, your biological clock speeds up, your heart rate speeds up, your blood pressure goes high, your platelets get sticky, your body gets inflamed. If you have a heart attack and you die, then you have run out of time. So experience is in time, but the experiencer, which is you as consciousness, is not in time. Let me go back. You as the conscious being is not a time. So when you remember your past and you remember your childhood, you remember your adolescence, who's that that remembers? You say, I remember. I is timeless. I is what we call the one, the awareness that is having the experience. So I is that which knows the experience, remembers the experience. All experience occurs in I, and then all experience disappears in I. Only I remains, with threads of memory and wisps of desire or karma. And this is karma, which is recycling all this. Everything you're experiencing is karma. So when people hear about this, they say, then we have no free will. That's not true. The past created the situation, circumstances, events of this, what is happening now. But what you do right now is up to you. So is there free will? Or is the universe determined and it's simultaneously both? If you're asleep, then there's no free will. And if you're awake, then there's infinite free will. Okay? It's all up to how aware we are. But expanding our awareness allows us to actually reinvent the experience that we call the body. What does change your relationship to time means? It means to be present. That's all. So as you're listening to me right now, just be aware of that which is listening. As you're listening to me, be aware of that which is listening. And that which is listening is a presence that is not in time. It's the same presence that was when you were a baby. Same presence when you were a teenager, now, tomorrow, everything. Experience will keep transforming, but the presence in which the experience is happening is always the same. So the ultimate goal of what is called enlightenment is called self-realization. Not even self-awareness, self-realization. Which means you realize who you are, okay? You're not the experience, you're that in which experience arises and subsides in every now. We can't even say moment of now, because the moment is over as soon as it arises. In every now. Now is the ticket to timeless being, which means eternity. In that sense, I is immortal, okay? Not I stretching for endless time, but I, which is not in time altogether. Okay, so I is immortal.